Welcome to Embracing Continuous Behaviour Change for Anger Management, the podcast that helps you to calm your emotions and communicate effectively. I'm your host, Claire Broadley, the Anger Management Coach. In this podcast, I'll bring you expert interviews, inspiring stories, and practical advice on calming your emotions and living a more peaceful and fulfilling life. So sit back, relax, and get ready to master your emotions. Good afternoon. Well, actually, it's good evening here in the UK. So good evening to everybody listening in the UK. Good afternoon or good evening to where else you are in the world. Good morning, even, David. We're joined today by David Garlock, and you're in the US, and it's in the afternoon there, I do believe.
Yes, I'm outside Philadelphia, so it's 1 o'clock right now.
Very nice. So for those listening, David is a national public speaker, keynote, criminal justice reform advocate, a research fellow, and a TEDx Arcadia speaker. So David, thank you so much. Have I missed anything?
No, plus I'm a dad. You know, I have a 3.5-year-old son, and that's probably one of my greatest jobs that I have.
Absolutely. Parenting is the best job in the world, isn't it?
Yes.
Heads up, and I've just seen it happen, my camera went off last time. So if it keeps going off, I am still here. I promise. I've not wandered off. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on my podcast. I saw you post something on LinkedIn, and it was so incredibly powerful, just the post. And hence I reached out and asked if you would like to be a guest. So thank you very much, because you have got one incredibly powerful story to tell. And I'm thrilled that you're prepared to share that with our listeners.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. It's something I always love to do, you know, because we can learn so much from other people and their stories and what they've been able to endure in life, you know. And when we see other people succeed, when we see other people who have been knocked down and are able to be picked up out of the miry, dusty, dirty mud, you know, and be able to be cleansed off and be able to have a life of success is so powerful for those individuals who find themselves in that mud or that situation where they need that hope, where they need to be able to dream again.
Absolutely. And that is so powerful. And I think what you say is as well is what has happened in your past doesn't define you. It's the here and now that makes you you.
Yeah, I always tell people my past does not define me. It's what's educated me. You know, the different things I've experienced in my life has given me wisdom, has given me understanding. And what defines me is what I do today, what I do tomorrow with that education that I have. And I love the opportunity that I get to share my story in this type of way in a podcast, or when I get to speak in universities, or when I'm doing a keynote at a conference or in a church, you know, being able to share my story and my faith and the way that they interconnect.
Yeah, brilliant. And I spoke to you about this before we pressed record, and I have taken a very short article. Would you call it an article?
It's more like a spoken word or kind of like a poem.
Okay. And I asked if you would allow me to read that out because I think it's incredibly powerful. And you said that was okay. And I think it's called I Am a Man.
Yeah, I call it I Am a Man and I Am a Victim.
I Am a Victim. Okay. So I hope I do it justice for you. I am a man and I am a victim. It's not one or the other, but I am both. This is a concept that many don't understand. Definitely one that I couldn't comprehend. During the time I was abused, shame, blame, and guilt insulated me from any type of feelings and wouldn't allow me to tell anyone. Those feelings made me think that no one would ever believe me, or accept what had happened to me, because I was a man and that didn't happen. My wounds were just covered with bandages, so no one could see how ravaged I was, covering upon covering just to escape the questions, but also to keep me breathing. Running deeper and deeper into the abyss was the way I stayed sane and protected. Until I no longer needed that, the truth came out and I shared and I told the story. I shared how I am a man, I am a victim. I am a man and I am a victim. It was raw and emotional. The bandages had scabbed up and each word shared was ripping open. The wounds were freshly open, pus and blood freely flowed. It wasn't a painful bleeding, but one in which I knew I would be healing. Layer after layer was discarded till there was no longer anything present except the wounds laid bare. The way the detective talked was like salve being wiped over the wounds. He was not demeaning me for what I did, but understanding of the act, because he was a man and was also a victim. David, that is so incredibly powerful. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about the behind of that poem or that story.
Well, one thing I love to do is I love to write. Writing is very healing for me. I did a whole bunch of writing while I was incarcerated, and I've done a whole bunch more since I've been out. But the backstory of that poem is about my experiences as somebody who was molested as a child. So my brother and I were molested by a non-family member who had befriended my brother and began molesting him back in 1990. The abuse began with me on January 1st, 1991. And this abuse went on for 8 years. And after the initial interaction with me, this individual told me that if I ever told anybody, he would kill my family or myself. Wow. So I had to begin to create masks. I had to begin to create different personas. You know, in psychology, they talk about it being disassociation.
Yeah.
So I had to separate myself from what was going on, because no one could know what was happening to me. And so that's where I was talking about the different wounds, you know, and these bandages, you know,
yeah.
No one could see. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the point that I was arrested on October 29th, 1999 for taking this individual's life that I began to take off those bandages. I was finally able at a point where I could tell somebody what had happened to my brother and me.
Mm.
And to tell somebody about the murder, because there was a 4-month period between the actual murder and being arrested. And that was a really hard time too, because here it is, I'm living with the fact that I had taken somebody's life. And to get through that time, it was all about just coping. So I was using any and every drug I could find or use, and drinking alcohol or vodka or liquor every night. I mean, that's how I got through that time.
Wow. And I'm sorry to hear about the abuse that you went through. That must have been absolutely awful. How, as a child, how old were you at that time, if you don't mind me asking?
I was 11 years old when the abuse began.
Okay. And how does an 11-year-old process and heal from that sort of childhood trauma?
Well, I mean, I wasn't able to process that and heal until I was actually arrested and I was in the county jail. I mean, I was in prison and I was reading a book about child sexual abuse. And in this book, it was talking about how people who are sexually abused as children blame themselves for the abuse. So my healing. And I'm going to say this one thing, too. I mean, this is something that you're always going to be healing from. I mean, healing from sexual abuse, healing from any trauma is not like healing from a scrape on your leg. You know, in 2 weeks, it's gone. You have a scar. I mean, it's a process. You know, there's going to be definitely things you're experiencing your whole life. It's it's like this onion, you know, there's so many different layers to what one experiences, you know. But one of the main things that has helped me was reading that book. And then I was able to have this conversation with the 11-year-old David and tell him it wasn't his fault, that I no longer had to blame myself for what had happened. And then really another aspect is my faith, you know, my trust and belief in God, and knowing that. And when I was going to church as a kid, when this was happening, I really didn't trust or believe in God, because I would always ask, like, how could a loving God allow this to happen?
Yeah.
And then when I was in prison, you know, I came to this realization that it wasn't God that allowed it, or it wasn't God who was doing it, but it was the sin in the world that allowed it. But God was there to comfort me in different ways and to place people in my life to help me and to help the healing process.
Oh, okay. So that almost, I nearly said the word salve then, which is the word that you used. It almost helped you to heal by using God. So for anybody who is listening who may also have gone through child sexual abuse, what advice to them would you give? As you just said, this can be something that you carry onward as a trauma throughout your adult life. What advice would you give to them in how to deal with that?
Well, I mean, there are multiple things that I would say, but the first thing is, somebody who is listening to this, who has never had the courage to tell anybody, that is the first step. You have to find the courage to tell somebody about what you've experienced. And that's the first step to healing. You know, if you think about Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, the first thing is you have to come, you have to admit you're powerless over it, you know? And that's the same thing with this. You know, you have to admit that this happened to you. Mm-hmm. Confess what happened. You know, that's the first step. The second thing is to find a counselor that is familiar with trauma, familiar with dealing with people who have been sexually abused as children. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing, which some people are always like, wait, what? Why do you want me to talk about it? You know, about it. Mm. The more you talk about it, the more power you have over your situation, the more power you have over that hurt, that pain. Another aspect of that is you get to define how that plays in your life now.
Yes.
So I get to go around in universities. I get to go to these conferences and speak and talk about being somebody who was victimized as a child. But in doing this, there's numerous people that come up to me afterwards and talk about their own abuse. And so what I've done is I've changed the narrative about what happened to me in a way that will provide healing and provide opportunities for others who are going through similar things to come to the point and say, that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah, you're almost giving them that empowerment. And that is so incredibly important, empowering people to take control over that trauma and not it control them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and when I talk about like trauma, I talk about two different, I use this analogy about a scab and a scar. And so if you have a scab on your arm, and it gets hit, the scab's going to come off. It's going to bleed. It's going to be painful. Mm-hmm. And then you get another scab, but then you knock that scab off. It's bleeding and painful. That's the cycle of somebody who hasn't healed from their trauma. That's that they're constantly going through this cycle where things are good. Something triggers them. They go back to that age of when they were harmed and they're there for a week or 2 weeks trying to deal with it.
Yeah.
Then things are okay again for another month, and then they're triggered again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the person that's like a scab. But the person that's like a scar is a person that's gone through the healing process, you know? And we know if you have a scar and you hit that scar, it's not going to bleed.
Yeah.
It's not going to be painful unless you hit it really hard. Then it might be a little painful.
Yeah.
But that scar does two things. One, it reminds you of the pain. It reminds you of where you've been, what you've endured, and how you've overcome.
Yeah.
But the second thing you're able to do with that scar is you're able to take that scar and show somebody who has a scab and let them know that healing is possible.
That is such a fantastic analogy. I love that. And I think I read about you say your brother handled it like the trauma, like it was a scalp, and you handled it like a scar. I honestly think that is such an excellent analogy for people to take away with them. And to empower people to talk and make talking about our pasts, our traumas, things that we have been resilient through is so powerful, and is so powerful for our mental health as well.
Absolutely, you know, because if we're not talking about it, we're just putting it within, you know. When I was in this behavior modification program in prison, we were taught about having a gunny sack. So think about this big backpack that we have on our back, and we have to get ready to go through this door. But everything that's happening in our life, we keep putting in this backpack. And so it gets to a point where it's so big, we can't get through that door.
Yeah.
So that is us going through life. That is us going through all these traumatic situations, this pain, this heartache, everything we experience in life. So what do we have to do to get through that door? We have to begin taking stuff out of the backpack.
Yeah.
We have to begin to unpack all of this stuff that's happened in our life. And then we're able to go out the door because the backpack is back to a smaller size and we can make it out the door.
Yeah. And we're lighter, so much lighter.
Oh, yeah.
Life easier. Absolutely. And I seem to remember reading that within your young teenage life as well, that you were made homeless. Was that before you went to live with the abuser?
Yeah, because there was a lot of situations that happened because the abuse was happening while I was still living with my dad. Every weekend, the abuse would happen because I would go see my mom and stepdad where this abuser and my brother were living. Okay. He had brought my mom and stepdad back up to Washington State from California just so he could have access to me. So every weekend, the abuse would happen. And then later on is when I was in the house and or wherever we were dwelling at that point because there was so much. But yeah, I lived on the streets when I was 16 for about a month and a half in Seattle, Washington. And that's one thing that my sister, my brother, and I all experienced was street life because we were kicked out in different points of our life. You know, I always tell people that if you looked up the word dysfunctional family in a pictorial dictionary, my family picture would be there because there was so much dysfunction, so much trauma, so much pain. I mean, one of the first memories I have was my dad chasing my mom and sister around with a hacksaw blade, threatening to kill them.
Wow.
And this was at 5 years old.
Gosh.
And so there was so much trauma, so many different experiences that we had in life. And that's one of the things that I talk about, you know, because when you think about people that end up in prison, so many of them have had these traumatic experiences. They have grown up in dysfunctional families or dysfunctional communities that aren't preparing them to succeed. They're in essence preparing them to end up in a carceral setting.
It almost is as if those people that they label as you just said, dysfunctional or too difficult to do anything with, it's almost like they just allow them to go downhill because they're too much money. We're going to have to invest too much to, I don't know, make them fit in the box we want them to fit in. So where are they going to end up? As you've said, on the streets or incarcerated. And that's awful.
And that's really where our society has failed. Because just like you said, it's like it would cost too much. It would take too much time and effort from us to help them. But the thought process we have to get is this. What if we do help those people?
Yeah.
What if we do take that time to sit down and have conversations with them and help them work through that trauma? Some of the work that I did after I got out of prison and graduated college is I worked with people who'd committed sexual offenses. People are always like, wait, what in the world? How can you work with this population? Yeah. And I always tell people, you know, it's about grace. It's about mercy. It's about forgiveness. I'm a client of Brian Stevenson in the Equal Justice Initiative. And he always says, you're not as bad as the worst thing you've ever done. And so working with these men, I realized that a lot of them had been sexually abused themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so just imagine if somebody took time to ask questions to these men when they were kids about being abused, what could have been stopped?
I had that exact same conversation with a chap yesterday who had been through sexual abuse in the UK and who himself ended up in prison. This exact same conversation about whilst he was in the education system, perhaps things could have been done because it was obvious then that life was going downhill for him. And maybe that could have been the case in your case when you were homeless. People surely, services surely must have seen that at that time.
Well, I mean, the services at that time really weren't focused on providing a lot of help. It seemed like it was more about providing a place for to sleep at night, potentially focusing on you being involved with some type of GED or other program like that, but really not having a social worker or psychologist or psychiatrist sitting down talking with people about their issues. And so really, I think that's where we need to get to. So I have done a presentation called How Social Workers Can Help Dismantle the Trauma to Prison Pipeline. And in it, I talk about the three different aspects of this trauma to prison pipeline is before somebody goes to prison, while they're in prison or when they get out. And before prison, a lot of that has to do with being in schools, you know, having conversations, educating parents, educating anybody who's going to be in a position of authority in this person's life about triggers, about red flags, about if your son or daughter's acting a certain way, you need to notice these things and begin to have questions. And then it's also about educating the children and letting them know that their parents or other people in positions of authority, that if something's happening, they are able to go talk to them and let them know what's happening to prevent anything from any further actions, any further contact, any abuse, anything like that. Because a lot of times kids are afraid to tell somebody because they don't know if they're going to be believed or not.
Yeah, and that's the awful thing. And as you've said, abusers more often than not will tell those children, I will kill you, I will kill your family, no one's going to believe you, and put the living fear of God into those poor kids.
And then another thing too is 95% of people who commit a sexual offense are known to the person that they abuse. Yeah. So this is a family member. This is somebody in church. This is a teacher. This is their Boy Scouts leader or a group leader. So somebody this person knows. So we have to get away from propelling this thought that stranger danger is where the sexual abuse is happening and really prepare our kids and teenagers to know that, okay, sexual abuse is going to happen by somebody you know, somebody who is working their way into your inner circle to have that closeness to you.
And I was just going to say then, do you think then as, I don't know, as parents or as a society, knowing that, do you think we let people into our lives too quickly and we're too trusting?
It can be that, but it's also that we're not aware of red flags. We're not watching close enough to things that are happening. If you have a neighbor named Billy Joe Bob, and Billy Joe Bob is giving your daughter new toys every week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something is wrong with that picture, right?
Absolutely.
Or if you have a teenager and they broke their phone and William down the street gives her a new cell phone that's cost $1,500, what are you going to think?
Yeah.
So we have to be more aware of things. We have to be able to have these conversations with our children and let them know that if certain things are happening, they need to tell us because that's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. Now, if Billy Joe Bob came up to me and was like, hey, I was out shopping and I saw this toy that I thought your daughter, your son would like, and I got it. Can I give it to them? That's a whole different story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if we may, and I don't want to go into the finer detail of it because we've already discussed this, but the taking the life of the abuser, that must be, you know, it's an incredibly complex and sensitive part of your story. But how did you cope with that aftermath? And you said that was 4 months after. How did you cope in those 4 months or even once you were arrested?
I mean, the way that I coped was, I mean, drugs and alcohol, any drug you could think of, I was using. So I was what you would consider a functional alcoholic or user because I knew that I had to work to make money for these drugs. And I was a waiter. So I think waiting tables was a benefit for me too, because here I am. What do you do to when you're waiting tables? You're acting, you know? Yeah. So I didn't have to really be me. I really didn't have to think about what had happened. I was just this happy-go-lucky waiter trying to make a whole bunch of money so I could get drugs. And what was really baffling about it is there were so many times that I had people that I was buying drugs from come to my work, and I'd be waiting on them, and I'd give them money. I'd put the drugs in my apron so I could have a whole bunch of pain pills. I could have some cocaine. I could have some marijuana in with my tips, you know? And I wasn't worried about like a cop coming and potentially busting me, because all I was thinking about is, hey, when I get off work, I'm going to get high, I'm going to get drunk, and I'm going to be numb. I'm not going to feel anything anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what my whole mentality was.
So how did it feel then when the police did come for you?
It was a shock because I didn't know. I never thought that we would be caught. I always had fear that we would. But then when it actually happened, I was like, oh, wow, this is actually happening. But there's a lot of fear, a lot of trepidation, because here I am. I had just turned 20 years old. And the murder happened in Alabama, which, if you don't know much about the United States, Alabama is one of those states that love to give out the death penalty. So I'm thinking I'm potentially going to get the death penalty or sentenced to life without parole, which means I would spend the rest of my life in prison. So that first weekend, I'm just crying myself to sleep. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was fearing that I was going to be put in the electric chair. And Alabama's electric chair had a nickname, and its nickname was Yellow Mama. And it was something that really had me so consumed with fear that first weekend. You know, November 1st, 1999, it was a Monday morning. I was taken over for more questioning in the city jail, and I'm put in this small, tiny interrogation room by myself for 7 hours. So I had a lot of time to think about the murder, think about the abuse, think about everything that had transpired. Mm-hmm. And I finally got to a point where I wanted to confess and tell everything that had happened. And when I did that, that was this big weight that was taken off my chest.
Yeah.
And they came in, videotaped it. And then what happened next changed the whole trajectory of my life. Me and the detective were heading back to the county jail. I'm sitting in the front seat with him. I had my arms handcuffed in front of me. I looked to him and I'm like, am I going to get the death penalty or life without parole? He turns to me. He's like, do you believe in God? I'm like, am I going to get the death penalty or life without parole? He's like, do you believe in God? I'm like, am I going to get the death penalty or life without parole? He's like, do you believe in God? And finally, I'm like, yeah, I believe in God. And he's like, you need to seek him now. And that conversation just changed the whole trajectory of my life, because when I got back to the county jail, I asked for a little New Testament Bible and I surrendered my life to God.
Wow. I have to ask, why yellow? What did they call the chair? Why?
So it's called Yellow Mama because the electric chair is this big honking metal chair that's painted yellow. There's a movie called Just Mercy. It's about the lawyer that worked with my brother and me, Brian Stevenson, and the Equal Justice Initiative. And they actually have a scene where one of the guys is actually being executed on the electric chair. And so you can get a good reference of what the electric chair looked like. Or you could just go to Google. You could go Google Yellow Mama Alabama and it'll come up and it'll share how the definition came too. So how the nickname came.
And am I right in thinking Alabama has the highest death penalty record? Is it? Am I right?
No, I don't think Alabama does. Actually, I think Texas might have the most people who they put to death. Actually, what's very interesting is back in 1976 was when they reinitiated the death penalty here in the U.S. Before then, they had gotten rid of it. And since then, you know, there's, I think, like 30 states who have gotten rid of the death penalty. And so really your main states that are doing the death penalty are like Texas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi. So a lot of your southern states that are in the Bible Belt.
Okay. So how long did you have to wait then for, I presume in the UK, they call it that you're being charged. So you're going to court for that offence. How long did you have to wait from being charged with it before finding out what your sentence was?
So I was in Alabama. What they do is you're arrested, then you have a preliminary hearing, which they tell you what you're being sentenced with or charged with. So my brother and I, we were charged with murder. So when we found out that we were being charged with murder, that was definitely a big relief, because murder, you can't get the death penalty or life without parole. Okay. So that was a relief knowing that we were charged with just murder. And we didn't receive our sentence for like 14 months. And after that, we pled out to it. And so we received a 25-year sentence. A lot of people are always like, wait, how did they give you a 25-year sentence? And I always tell people that they could have easily charged us with another offense, which is called justifiable homicide. And that offense would have only carried a 1 to 10 year sentence. So we probably would have only done 2.5 years in prison if we had received a charge like that.
Okay. And you actually went on and served 13 and a half years?
Yeah. So total, I served 13 and a half of the 25-year sentence. And then I was on parole for just over 9 years before I received my pardon in 2021.
Okay. So what have you learned about forgiveness for others and for yourself throughout that experience? So you said the detective said, do you believe in God? So was that the turning point where you began to forgive yourself? Were you ever able to forgive the abuser?
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten to a point where I've forgiven myself and forgiven the abuser, but it's a process, you know? I forgave the abuser before I got out of prison, but then there have been different things that have allowed that forgiveness to go deeper. So I'd say that we can forgive people on kind of like a surface level, mm-hmm. but then things happen that allow that forgiveness to go deeper, because we might not have realized how deep that hurt or pain went. Yeah. And then there's different things in our life that allows us to realize that pain was deeper. And so we're able to offer that much more forgiveness. I'd say one thing that definitely helped me do that was working with individuals who had committed sexual offenses. It's a job that I never thought I would have. And it just came about by God opening different doors. My wife actually found the job on this app called Idealist. And it was this a reentry program director in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, part-time. I was like, okay, sounds perfect. I applied, and then the first interview I had with the executive director, he's like, tell me some stuff about you. So I shared my story with him, and he's like, I have a question for you. I was like, okay. He's like, can you work with people who've committed sexual offenses? Because that's primarily who we work with. And I'm like, absolutely. Because of my belief in grace, mercy, forgiveness. And that's how I began in this work, you know, and I was in that role for 3 years. I looked at that role, especially now looking back, is as restorative justice.
Yeah.
When you think about restorative justice, it's all about wholeness. It's about bringing the person who has caused harm with the person who has been harmed and allowing them to have dialogue. Mm-hmm. A lot of these men that I worked with were never going to be able to talk to the person that they had harmed. So here I was able to be the victim by proxy for them.
Yeah.
I was able to have these conversations with them and let them know how somebody who has been harmed would react and how that would make somebody feel. And it was so powerful just to see these men not only ask for forgiveness for the person they harmed, but actually get to a place where they forgave themselves. Because when you're in a place where you can't forgive yourself, that is a worse prison than any prison in the world. Because that's a prison that you created yourself, and you're keeping yourself there.
And I think, as you've said, by being able to be that victim by proxy, was almost perhaps educational for the men to hear how they've made a victim feel. Perhaps not their victim, but it's a victim's voice. And that's so helpful. Here and at times very needed.
Yeah, I mean, it's if somebody who has caused harm is able to have those type of conversations, it provides a different perspective, you know, because I think really when you think about the legal system in the US, in the UK, anywhere, it really doesn't provide the opportunity for a conversation between the person that's caused a harm and the person that's been harmed. Yeah. And that's really what's needed, you know? Does seeing somebody go to jail or prison for an extended period of time heal somebody?
No, absolutely not.
It provides a false sense of security.
Mm.
Because now that person that has harmed them can't harm them or harm somebody else.
Yeah.
But there's other people that can harm them. But it hasn't allowed them to deal with what happened to them. It hasn't allowed them to ask why were they chosen, why all these different questions that they have.
Mm.
And then another thing too is that those questions allow that healing to begin. Then that person wouldn't have to be fearful to walk down the street. They wouldn't be triggered as much if they heard different sounds similar to when they were harmed. So I think that's really where we have to get to. We have to get away from a punitive system and get more to a restorative, transformative system that is about healing. You know, why do we have to put somebody in prison for 50 years?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've read that victims quite often will blame themselves. So as you've said about the restorative justice, victims might be saying, it was my fault. Did I do this? Did I not lock my door? Did I wear a dress that was too short, too long, whatever? And by having those questions answered can, you know, calm their mind perhaps to a degree. So, yeah, I agree. They need some questions answering. So if we talk about your emotional resilience and moving forward from everything that has happened, which has been so impactful in your life, how do you consciously work to ensure that your past experiences don't define you as a person?
I'd say a lot of it is just constantly in counseling. You know, it's always important to continue to have conversations, continue to talk about ways that my past continues to come back into my life, you know, and it could be in my relationship with my wife or other things, you know. One thing that my wife did early on in our marriage is she read a lot of books about child sexual abuse. So she knew my coping mechanisms. She knew that I did not like to deal with confrontation and I was shut down. Mm-hmm. And so she would always challenge me and she's like, okay, you're doing it again. And I'm like, why do you have to know all this stuff? It's like, let me just shut down and not deal with this. So I think that's definitely one thing. Definitely my faith continues to help working things out. But again, it goes back to being able to speak about it, you know, because the more I speak about it, the more power I have over it. And that's the thing that is so incredible, is the thing that held me in such a negative place, the thing that I feared the most, I now am able to use to empower others. I'm able to use to show people what a healing journey looks like. I'm able to talk about the shame, to talk about what I experienced in life, to help other people be free.
And that's owning it, isn't it? It's absolutely saying, you are not having my power. You are not keeping me, you know, trapped, shut down. I'm not going to be that person. I am going to own you. And therefore, no one can ever hold that over you, against you, because you are there shouting it from the rooftop, saying, this is me. This is who I am. And what I have overcome and how resilient I am.
Yeah. And so many people ask me, they're like, man, how do you do what you do? And I tell them, it's like, I own it. You know, I get to define how what happened to me is played out in my life.
Yeah.
Do I want it to be something that continues to control me and keeps me in a prison? Or do I want to use it as a prison key to help other people get out of their prison?
Yeah, absolutely. And just on that, what inspired you to help others and to be advocating for those who have faced similar challenges?
I'd say one of the main things is Brian Stevenson. He's the founder of Equal Justice Initiative. He's a lawyer that worked with my brother and me and helped us get out on parole and pardon, and just seeing his life and seeing the impact that he has had over the years. The other is I was invited to speak at a university my senior year in college. And that opportunity, just seeing how the students were resonating with my story and how they asked questions, you know, and how they were just drawn in to what I had experienced and wanting to make changes in the criminal legal system. You know, that encouraged me so much. And I've spoken at about 70 universities across the United States now. And it's incredible because if you told me that I would have been doing that when I got out of prison, I would have been like, yeah, okay, whatever. Who wants to hear me? And what does my story have to do with anybody? And how can people relate to it? But I'm always just renewing and redoing things because I want to be able to share my story in a way that it relates to anybody and everybody. I don't just want to be able to speak to people in criminal justice classes. I want to be able to speak to anybody in a university where they can listen to me and they can be challenged in whatever profession they're going into to be able to be an encouragement, be able to help people, you know, because that's what it's about. You know, we need to be willing to help people. We can't just get into this thought process that it's all about David Garlock. Forget Claire, forget you, forget anybody else. It's all about me.
And how does it feel to know that you are challenging what effectively are, you know, soon to be professionals? You're challenging their perspectives on whether that's life or making judgments of others.
Well, I mean, I love it, you know, and what's amazing about it is there's so many times where I'm planting seeds, you know, with my conversations with what I'm saying. And a lot of times we don't get to see those seeds, you know, come to fruition. Like your podcast, you know, you're planting seeds in people's lives who you might never know that was impacted by you.
Yeah.
But what's so powerful is those times that you get to see the impact. So I was on a podcast on April 1st. With one of my colleagues at the University of South Florida. And I spoke at their university 2 years ago. And so I was speaking to a class. I shared, we had a Q&A. And then during the Q&A, one of their students came on. She's like, I don't have a question, but I want to say something. I was like, okay. She's like, I remember when you came and spoke 2 years ago, I was there in the class. She's like, when I came to South Florida, I wanted to be a prosecutor. It's like, I wanted to go lock people up and put them in prison for a long time. It's like, after you hearing your story and the depth of it and just seeing the realness of you, she's like, now I want to be a defense attorney. I want to help people that are being charged with offenses. And I started getting teared up in this, you know, because it's one of those moments where you're like, wow. I had a profound impact on somebody's life.
Yeah.
And it was just incredible seeing that she went from wanting to lock somebody up for the rest of their life to wanting to help somebody where they don't end up in prison, you know? And it was just like, it was powerful.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, that is such a powerful story. I think it's very, very easy for us to point the finger of blame at people without ever listening or asking them their story. And I think, sorry, go on.
Absolutely, you know, and I always tell people too, you know, when you point a finger at somebody, always realize you have three fingers pointing back at you. So, yeah. I mean, it's one thing, you know, for us to like, always talk about somebody else, you know, but we have to make sure that our garden is clean before we start talking about somebody else's garden.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about a typical day. So what was a typical day for you now? How do you continue to grow and develop emotionally?
I did not hear you. Somehow my sound went out there. Can you repeat the question?
Absolutely. What does a typical day look like for you now? And how do you continue to grow and develop emotionally?
A typical day. Well, sometimes it's waking up at 5 o'clock because I have a 3.5-year-old son, you know, and we just spend some time together and cuddle. And then I have to take him to his daily routines. Sometimes he's out for the whole day. And then it's just a each day is different. You know, some days I'm doing legislative visits. So some of the work I do here in Pennsylvania is we're working to create parole eligibility for elders and people who have a lot of medical conditions who are in prison, and also parole for people who have given life without parole sentences. I'm doing a lot of work with different organizations, setting up the different speaking engagements. To be a public speaker, there's a lot of legwork behind speaking. You know, you're constantly sending out emails, connecting with folks, different things like that. Then, I mean, really just listening to podcasts, listening to different things to increase my faith. In the evenings, spending time with my wife and son. Just a lot of different things.
Cool. Great. So advice for others then. What message would you like to convey to others who might be struggling with to overcome their own past traumas?
I mean, the first thing I would say is, you know, if you've never shared about what you're going through, share it. Talk to somebody. It's going to be the greatest step that you've ever taken. It's not the last step. It's the first step. But it's you're going to receive so much power from that. And that's going to begin the healing journey. Those who are already on the journey, just continue. Keep your head up. Know that there's going to be times where you might get knocked down. But keep getting up. I mean, just think about this. If I'm in a boxing match with Lennox Lewis, you know, because I know that he was a British fighter, so people over there might know more about him than if I said Mike Tyson. But think about I'm in this boxing match with Lennox Lewis, you know, and he knocks me down in the first round, but I get up. He knocks me down in the second round, but I get up. And each continuous round, he knocks me down, but I keep getting up. Yeah. And then in the 12th round, I dodge one of his right hooks and I come in with this uppercut that connects and I knock him out. Who wins the boxing match?
Yeah, absolutely.
I do.
Yeah.
Because I knocked him out in the 12th round. It doesn't matter that he knocked me down in the first 11 rounds. What matters is I knocked him out in the 12th round.
Yeah.
So just keep fighting. Just keep getting up because you will win.
Brilliant advice. And what advice would you give to your younger self if you could go back to those times when life was incredibly difficult, when it was dysfunctional, etc.? If you could give your younger self some advice, what would it be?
Just tell them that life is going to be a lot better, and just to keep persevering and know that, you know, the end is better than the beginning.
Brilliant. And lastly, what do you, or how do you envision continuing to help others and make a difference in the future?
I mean, some of the work that I'm doing is I'm a teacher's assistant with our prison education program. So I love being able to go in and to help educate these men that are in prison. And it also empowers them because they're able to see me, somebody who's formerly incarcerated, and what I've been able to do in the 11 years that I've been out. Also, just continuing to speak every opportunity I have, being on podcasts, you know, because getting stories out there is so powerful, you know, because stories make people feel, people can relate to it. They can say, okay, I can relate to David because I've experienced A, B, and C, you know? So it's so important for people to hear that other people have gone through the same thing that they have and to see where they are, you know? So it provides that hope. It gives them the ability to dream.
Absolutely. Lastly, do you have any final words or anything that you would like to send our listeners away with?
I mean, I just say, you know, continue to listen to Claire's podcast. She's amazing. And just know that, you know, if you've experienced trauma, if you've experienced pain, if you've experienced hurt, that doesn't have to define you. You might be in a place where you're a scab, but know that becoming a scar is possible. And then you can use that hurt and pain you've experienced previously in your life to help other people heal.
Lovely. How can our listeners reach out to you, David, should they want to do so?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter, David Lee Garlock. I'm on LinkedIn. They can always find you on LinkedIn and then just search my name there. For speaking opportunities, I have a website, davidlgarlock.com. And I've never spoken across a pond. So, you know, I would love for some universities and other folks to reach out to me. I would love to come across a pond and speak. I have a passport. I have a pardon. I can travel anywhere.
Lovely. David, I'll put your links onto the podcast and the bio, et cetera, so people can get to you very easily. Thank you so much for being a guest. It's been an absolute honor and a privilege speaking to you this evening or this afternoon.
Thank you so much. And it was an honor for me too.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to the episode and learn some tips on how to manage your emotions in a healthy way. If you've been affected by anything in the podcast, or if you want to share your feedback or questions, please email claire@angermanagementcoach.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and do remember, you have the power to calm your emotions and communicate effectively.